Focus on your breath. To see it clearly, you may want to take a couple of good, long, deep in and out breaths to notice where you feel the breathing process, wherever it's most prominent, wherever it's easiest to focus your attention, settle your mind right there, and then allow the breath to become comfortable. Notice that statement of when it is a matter of allowing. But it's telling you something you should do. But it's something also at the same time that's very comfortable right in the present moment. Telling you you should have a sense of well-being. Or do what you can. The Buddhist shoulds are all based around the proposition that what we want, true happiness, is something we should not be embarrassed about and something we should not feel ashamed about. It's a noble goal, because true happiness is not just hedonistic. It's not selfish. It's something that requires noble qualities in the mind. Things like wisdom and compassion and purity. Discernment, integrity. These are all good things. As we stay with the breath and we get it comfortable like this, we're providing a safe space right here in the present moment where all the parts of the mind can come together. And particularly the parts that we tend to identify with the head and with the heart, which often seem to be at cross purposes. You think about Freud's analysis of the mind. He said, on the one hand, there's the id, which is just your basic desire for pleasure. And then there's the superego, which tells you what you should and shouldn't be doing. And then you've got the ego in between, which is negotiating these two. And the poor ego is faced with the fact that the shoulds of the superego have very little to do with what's making you really happy. And so there's going to be a conflict. But the Buddha's shoulds are very different. I mean, Freud was raised in a religion where your true happiness was basically shoved off to the side. And there were lots of duties placed on you that had nothing to do with your happiness. But here the Buddha is recommending that you take on duties that are directly connected to your genuine well-being and your genuine happiness. In other words, there's not necessarily a conflict between your desire for happiness and the shoulds of his path. The conflict that does exist is because you have lots of members of your mind who have some pretty strange and narrow ideas of what happiness is. And you've got to train them. What this means is you've got to show them that the happiness they propose is not the genuine article. But there is a way to find a true happiness, and to whatever extent they can be converted over to that goal, they're welcome to the safe space. It's the totally unreasonable members of the mind. Not have to be pushed out. But you find that the extent to which you identify with those members is based on the fact that you don't really know them well, and you don't really have a good sense of what true happiness can be. This is why part of the safe space here in the present moment is that it is very comfortable. In the beginning, it may not seem like much. You're just simply breathing in, breathing out, and it feels fairly ordinary. But if you pay really careful attention to the breath and notice, at what point does the in-breath start to feel uncomfortable? Well, stop. And then you can breathe out. At what point does the out-breath feel uncomfortable? Well, stop. And in between, does it feel better for the breath to be short, heavy or light, fast or slow? And how far should it go down into the body? And where is the boundary of the breath? As you get to know the in and out breathing process, you begin to realize there's an energy flow that exists on many levels in the body and can fill the whole body. And the more you can get all those different types of energy working together with a sense of ease and well-being, the pleasure that comes from the breath, even a sense of rapture, fullness, refreshment, gets stronger and stronger. So this does become a really good place to be. And the parts of the mind that want instant happiness can be convinced, well, here's a way of experiencing happiness very directly, so experiencing pleasure. The Pali word for pleasure, ease, happiness, well-being, bliss, is all the same word, sukha. Sukha, this can be experienced on fairly subtle levels or much more blatant levels. What they all have in common is a sense of well-being. It feels good to be here. So it makes the more difficult members of your mind more willing to talk, more willing to listen to reason. Because the reason here is basically devoted to your well-being. When the Buddha set forth his main teaching, the Four Noble Truths, each of the truths entailed a duty. The duty is designed to lead you to happiness. In other words, you can take on the duties or not as you want. The Buddha is saying, though, if you want true happiness, then this is what you have to do. And it's not that he designed the duties or something. These were things that he discovered in his own practice. The first truth, stress or suffering, is something you should comprehend. Particularly here we're talking about stress and suffering in the mind. And that's the stress and suffering that the mind inflicts on itself by hanging on to things, by feeding on things that are actually going to lead to more misery on sometimes subtle levels and sometimes on blatant levels. Now, our ordinary reaction to that kind of suffering is we don't want it. You sit down and meditate and you find that you're feeling miserable. You want to get up and run away. But you're never going to learn anything about those states of mind. You're never going to understand them. You have to be able to sit with them. This is why we have the other truths. In other words, if you can see what's arising together with the suffering, and the Buddha says it's going to be craving of one form or another, either sensual craving, the idea that you're fascinated with thinking about sensual pleasures, what they call craving for becoming, in which you want to take on a particular identity, or craving for no becoming, in which you don't like the identity you've got and you want to destroy it. These are the things that accompany your suffering, and these are the things that cause it. Now, we engage in these things out of ignorance, but if you can comprehend the suffering, you begin to see at the same time there is this companion to suffering, the cause. And if you abandon the companion, the suffering goes away. So this gives you encouragement that you're not just going to be sitting here with suffering all the time. Once you see that there's a cause, you can let go of it. You develop the path, which starts with the right view and ends with the right concentration, to give you the strength to deal with these things. In other words, you've got this safe space here, and you can ask the right questions. What's causing the suffering? If we focus on the extent to which we're suffering because of things outside, things that other people did, we're asking the wrong questions. You have to ask yourself, what am I doing right now that's contributing to this? That's right view. And the concentration, the mindfulness, these are qualities that enable us to stay here with a relative sense of well-being so that we're not totally sucked into the suffering. We have a safe place to stay. So we begin to realize that we've noticed that there's a kind of craving and you let go of it. There is, at least for the moment, a cessation of suffering. You want to pay attention to that because that gets you more and more inclined to want to let go of other kinds of craving. that as your concentration gets more and more solid, you're able to see even more subtle levels of craving that are causing more subtle levels of suffering. Let them go as well. So all these duties work together and enable you to sit with the suffering and not feel like you're overwhelmed by it. And you begin to understand, because it's understanding the suffering is the only way you get past it. As the Buddha said, to understand these things, there are five steps. First, you want to see them arise. Say, for example, you've got a feeling of guilt or remorse about something you've done. And it's not the case that it's going to be there 24/7. It comes and it goes. Even if you're having an hour where it's mainly preoccupied with remorse, it's not continuous. It'll come for a bit and then it'll go. Then it'll come back again and it'll go. And so you ask yourself, when does it come? When does it go? That allows you to step back from it a bit. So you're not totally sucked in. You're looking at the process. And then when it comes, you ask yourself, what's coming along with it? In particular, what is it that makes the mind want to grab onto it? The Buddha calls this the allure. Even though there may be mind states that we really don't like, there's part of us that does actually like them. Remember, the mind is not a single monolithic thing. It's lots of parts, lots of voices, lots of opinions in there. And so when the sense of guilt comes, part of the mind actually likes it. And you want to see, what is it that it likes? Does it feel like it's going to pay off the debt by feeling more and more guilt? That's one thing the mind does. The idea that if we make ourselves suffer enough, then we'll repay whatever debt we feel that we're guilty for. But if you look at that idea, you realize that it doesn't really make any sense. A lot of these parts of the mind have their power because they stay in the shadows. And they're able to stay in the shadows because they keep saying, well, I can't be brought into the discussion because I'll immediately be pushed out. And if the discussion isn't held in a skillful way, nothing gets resolved. But here we're creating that safe space where these different voices in the mind, these different members of the heart or the mind. It's interesting in Buddhism, they use the word citta, which means both heart and mind. They don't divide it between heart and mind. Again, because we're all working for the same purpose, true happiness. So you've got this safe space, you'll be able to see these things. And then you can compare the allure of the guilt or the remorse with the drawbacks that you'd see. You weigh yourself down. I mean, it's one thing to recognize you've made a mistake, but as the Buddha said, remorse doesn't go back and change the past. It actually makes it harder to learn from your lessons in the past, learn from your mistakes in the past so you don't repeat them in the future. There's nothing virtuous about feeling a lot of guilt. You learn to recognize the mistake, you make up your mind not to repeat it, and then the Buddha says you extend thoughts of goodwill to yourself and all beings. Extend goodwill to all beings so that you don't make mistakes and mistreat them again. You extend goodwill to yourself to remind yourself that you're doing this for your own well-being. The fact that you've recognized a mistake is not meant to tear you down. It's actually meant to help you. So these are some of the dialogues you can have. As you see the drawbacks and compare them with the allure, you begin to see it's not worth it. The allure is not worth it. The drawbacks way outweigh the allure. And that's when you develop some dispassion for that particular mind state. And when you develop dispassion, that's when you can let it go. And you're freed from it. Back in the Buddhist time, they felt that fire burned because it was clinging to fuel. This is why they have the image of nirvana, which literally means the fire is going out. It goes out because it lets go of the fuel. It's freed because it lets go. It's not that the fuel traps the fire. The fire is trapped by its own holding on. There's a message there. Which you've been clinging to things that cause you to suffer. And it's not that they're holding you there. You're the one who's holding on to them. If you learn how to gain some dispassion for them, you let go. And then you're freed. And what are you freed into? The Buddha said it's the ultimate happiness. That's at the end when you've taken care of all the members of the mind. And the mind gets more and more unified in its agreement that this is the way you want to find happiness, based on this path of virtue, concentration, and discernment. With concentration, the big middle ground. Like getting the mind right here in the present moment with a sense of well-being. Where the parts of the mind that tell you what you should and shouldn't be doing are telling you you should work for true happiness. And all the other parts of the mind learn what true happiness means. Everything comes together. The mind becomes a more and more unified mind. With a lot less conflict inside. So it takes some time to work on this safe ground, this safe space here in the present moment, where all the different parts of the mind can come to the table. And their conflicts can be resolved. And in their resolution, you find that a true happiness really is possible. What the Buddha said is true. There is a deathless happiness. And it comes from bringing the mind together like this, the heart and the mind, all their parts. They come together as one, and then they go beyond the oneness. But the sense of oneness in the present moment is where the dialogue can begin.